Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Australia's not a very religious country, and if you ask me why, part of the reason I think is that curiously, there appears to be so much grief associated with it all. Religions seemingly at war with each other, even conflict within individual brands of religion. Think of it this way, if it was a footy code or team, who'd want to join that club or code? For God's sake, is a refreshing exception to all the religious wars. It's a new book written by four Aussie authors, an atheist, a Jew, a Christian and a Muslim. And thank the Lord, they are civil and sensible, while able to be clear and open about their differences. I'm so very glad that we've been able to get all four of them together for a very open house conversation. They are Jane Caro, an author, columnist, broadcaster and atheist, Anthony Lowenstein, an independent Australian journalist, photographer, blogger and Jewish atheist, Simon Smart, a director with the Centre for Public Christianity, and Rachel Woodlock, an academic writer and Muslim. They demonstrate that, in Jane's words, respect and civility do not mean wishy-washy or timid. So we have Jane, Anthony and Simon in the studio and Rachel on the phone from Ireland, where she now lives. Welcome to you all to Open House.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you with us. I want to start by asking each of you briefly how and why you came to your respective positions of faith. Because I think no matter where we are on the faith spectrum, it always is a choice about what to believe or not. Jane, can I start with you as an atheist?
Yeah, absolutely. I've realised that I'm quite unusual because I'm probably at least a third generation atheist, certainly on my father's side. We think the family was probably Jewish at some point, but there is literally no memory of that. There is no even ex-religion in my father's family. It's just a religion-free zone. Doesn't exist. My mother's side, her parents were Methodist and in fact met as Sunday school teachers, but she's such a lapsed Methodist one could call her an anti-Methodist, in fact. For me, like many people of faith, mine is an inherited position. I was born into a family where religion was simply not part of our discussion. And although I've had flirtations with experimenting with believing in things during my life, I guess I've rather comfortably in my 50s returned to the non-faith of my father's.
It's a very common story. Rachel, how about you? How and why did you come to an Islamic faith?
I've always had a belief in God, so that's not something that I've ever had to arrive at. It's just been something that has always been with me. But I also had to use, I suppose you'd say, my mind when I was studying Islam at university, and you know, I had to read a lot and make some decisions about what I believed. So it's a mixture of both my heart and my head, I suppose I'd say.
There was one moment you spoke to God like this in an outback town in far north Queensland. God, I give my life to you. And you say you were immediately flooded with beauty and love. But that was before you became a Muslim. It was independent of religion.
Yeah, that's right. I've never felt that it was connected to a particular religion. I really felt, at the time I was talking to God, I had just was completely overwhelmed with this sense that this was God. And so it never really has occurred to me that it sort of belonged to a particular religion.
Simon, can I ask you, how did you come to your position of faith then?
Like Jane, I was brought up in a family that had particular beliefs. In my case, it was a very Christian family. My dad was an Anglican minister, in fact. And so I say in the book, Jane and I are as original, as rebellious as each other in that sense. I'd like to think it's not as straightforward as that. I mean, I had lots of times where I was very uncomfortable with that belief in important. And when I was at university, I was sort of really much living like God didn't have much place in my life. But I couldn't ever ultimately get away from the God question. So it's things like the wonder of life, the amazing fact of existence that pushes me in that direction to begin with. I just can't get away from that. I guess I'm not satisfied with the thoroughly materialistic physical explanations of things like beauty and love and our search for justice, those sorts of things.
Anthony, can I ask you to explain what Jewish atheism is and how you came to that?
It might seem contradictory. In short, what that means is that there are very, very few Jews who would have said before the Second World War that they're Jewish and atheist. Obviously, they existed, but it was uncommon. What's, I think, happened in the last 60-odd years, particularly since the Holocaust, is a sense somehow that Jews who, in my case, I grew up in Melbourne, a liberal Jewish home. I went to synagogue a number of times a year, as most Jews do. For Jewish holidays, didn't keep a kosher home. My family then and now were liberal and in terms of their religious affiliation. But I think what's happened in the last 60 years is Israel, of course, was born in 1948, and the effect of that has been that for the majority of Jews before the Second World War, including my family who were in Germany at the time, the idea of being a Zionist, the concept of believing in a Jewish state, was completely bizarre. Why would you, as a Jew in, say, Dresden, where my family is from, want to move to Palestine? It seemed insane. Now, of course, the Holocaust changed everything for self-evident reasons. But the effect of, for many Jews, including me, is that I feel proudly Jewish in terms of the history of descent that exists within Judaism. But I don't practice my religion at all. And the reason that I'm atheist is I don't believe in God or any kind of affiliation religiously. And the effect for me and many, many Jews, unfortunately not enough Jews in my view, but growing numbers of Jews around the world, is a disaffection with Israel and the ways in which Israel treats Palestinians under occupation. And that is making, although Judaism and Zionism are not the same thing, it's self-evident to say that, and I'd explain that in the book, for many Jews, Israel has become the religion to replace their own religion of Judaism.
Yeah. Your book helpfully explores a wide range of questions, and each of you offer your own perspectives. I don't want to explore all of it and blow it all for now, but I do want to cover a few. The first one, the nature of the universe and what it is to be human. Simon, how do you account for all of that from a Christian perspective?
These are really critical questions, I think. And so one of the good things about this book is we get to explore those deep, important questions right at the beginning. And then a lot of the other things flow out from that. So Richard Dawkins says we have exactly, in the universe, we have exactly what you'd expect if there's no God. And that believers have to face that. And maybe he might be right. That's possible, of course. But I sometimes like people to sort of think about the implications of that belief of a meaningless, comfortless, valueless universe, which in my mind has to be at least to some degree if there's nothing outside of that universe. And so for many people, I'm a bit like this, like Anthony Flew, who was an atheist for much of his life and towards the end became a theist of some sort. He looked at the DNA and saw 3.5 billion letters in exactly the right order, decided that it just couldn't have happened without a God. And so I want to look at that and think about what sort of the reality that we live in. I don't think it's like Jane will tell us, which is that it's a sort of a neutral position to say there's no God. I think that has a whole lot of positive entailments, and I want to explore those.
Jane, what do you say?
I don't think it's a neutral position to say there's no God. I agree with Simon. It does have a whole lot of things that flow out of that. But my view is this, the fact that if something happens to me in my life that's really tragic and traumatic or very exciting and wonderful, it has enormous meaning to me. But for the vast majority of people going about their business who don't know me or anything about me, it has no meaning. Does that make it any less meaningful to me? No, it doesn't. It makes no difference. That's the way the world is. I see the universe in very much that sense. I don't think it knows I even exist or cares. It is benign. It is neither malevolent nor wonderful. It is just indifferent to another one of the things that's popped into existence because of its chemical makeup. That's fine. This is why I maintain, and I have no problem with that. It doesn't frighten me. It doesn't make me feel nihilistic or suicidal. I find meaning in my own life and my relationships with other human beings. That's as big as it needs to be for me. I see atheism, in fact, far less, it's often called arrogant, but I see it as the ultimate in humility because it says human beings are of no greater value than any other part of the universe or any other creature. Amoeba are us, as far as atheists are concerned. And for me, that is actually a really nice thing to think. It doesn't make me feel like a lesser creature.
Okay, second question. How do we know right from wrong? First, Rachel.
Generally speaking, every culture has a sense of justice, of right from wrong. We have something that human beings, even little kids, you know, when their toy gets nicked by another toddler, they know there's something wrong. So we have, there's a sense of right from wrong that is universal and sort of stands independent from arbitrary thinking about things. It becomes a little bit more complex when you have competing rights or competing wrongs, when you have to apply, you know, a little bit of thinking to an issue. But we have a sense of independent right and wrong. The difficulty is not so much knowing right from wrong, it's actually applying it.
Anthony, as a Jew, how do you determine in your mind what's right and wrong?
I think when I was growing up in Melbourne, and I'm in my late 30s now, so I grew up in the 70s and 80s, my parents instilled in me values that I guess you could say weren't really, I mean, they were Jewish to the extent that they were not based on the Torah, the Jewish holy book, but they were based on Western liberal values, I guess, of sorts. So I suspect pretty similar to all of us. There was no belief in enforcing an idea about Moses or the Ten Commandments. I mean, obviously, most of us can basically agree on the Ten Commandments. I mean, the idea, I think, about right and wrong is that we can't get away in the West from the concept of a Judeo-Christian background. That's where we come from. But these debates in some ways are relatively narrow, aren't they? Because ultimately, if we talk in the non-Western world, which of course is the majority of the world, the idea somehow that people will say when you go to India or Palestine or much in the Middle East, as I've often done for work, that for them the idea of someone like me who says that I'm an atheist basically doesn't really believe in a higher being that sort of informs me or I take lessons from my holy book, they find that incomprehensible. I'm not saying that saying that they're less intelligent. I'm simply saying that for them, the idea that one doesn't have a moral framework dictated by religion is incomprehensible. For me, what's right and wrong, and obviously I think we have a moral code that you can't ignore growing up in Australia, that it was informed by a, I guess, liberal religious background to the extent that I went to an Anglican school, etc. But in terms of how I live my daily life, it's relatively simple, and I agree with Jane. Be good to other people, be kind, don't hurt other people, try to avoid that as much as possible. And for me, as a journalist, I always see myself as a human being first and a Jew second, that as a journalist, I've often been attracted to the idea that we have a responsibility, to me, as if you're a good journalist, to actually give a voice to those who haven't had the opportunity to have that voice, and that's mostly underprivileged people or whoever it may be, and that's what I've done throughout my work.
Two issues combined for you, Rachel and Simon, the question of suffering and where do you find hope in life? Simon, I'll start with you.
I would acknowledge that this question of suffering is the biggest challenge to my faith. There's no question of that. The idea of an all-powerful, good God who somehow allows some of the most dreadful suffering to continue causes me my biggest doubts. I think there are a lot of unanswered questions in terms of that, in terms of my faith and that sort of God. But two things I'd say about that. One is this big story of this, of Jesus, for instance, is the story of a God who doesn't remain aloof from the suffering, but becomes part of it, who engages in that, endures it himself in this sort of strange way. But the other thing is that that story enables enormous hope of not only a future, but a future that impacts the present. And so that's what I come down on. I'm hanging on to that story as a very coherent, beautiful, logical story that offers hope in the present suffering, even if it doesn't answer all the questions.
Rachel, what about you? The question of suffering, and where do you find hope?
Well, suffering is, from an Islamic perspective, is part and parcel of the material world that we live in. We can only know good because of evil, unfortunately. So there is a sense within the Islamic world that even though we should resist suffering and we should try and change, you know, people who are suffering, we should try and alleviate it, that's just part and parcel of this experience that we're having. In terms of finding hope, again, I think that this is something that's innate to human beings. We have hope because we can see into the future and we can respond to, from an Islamic perspective, the prophets who say that there will be a time when there won't be suffering and that we will have healing. So that's something that gives me hope. Even though at times you look at what happens in the world and you feel incredibly frustrated.
Okay, I think it's important to include you all in this next question because it's a big question, especially for Jane, where I'll start. Doesn't religion oppress women? What do you say?
Yes. I think the simple answer is yes.
Yeah.
And I think the evidence for that is overwhelming, particularly historically, but it continues to this day. I don't buy that there should be one set of rules for one half of the human race and a different set for the other, which somehow always seems to work out for the other. I mean, I often hear this term equal but different, which always frightens me because it was exact term used to justify apartheid in South Africa, which everyone forgets when they use it in a benign kind of way to women. Exactly. It's always used to oppress one group. And what happens with equal but different is that it is always working out really well for the equal, but it's really lousy for the different. And women in religious traditions are always the different. They're always the not norm. Always the second class. This is in all the religious books and all the texts. And we are often excluded, marginalised, minor figures. I mean, the Holy Trinity, I find this quite extraordinary. We have God the Father, God the Son, Jesus, and then God the Holy Spirit? Oh, get over yourselves. Normal human family is God the Mother, surely. And yet we are left out. Our physical self terrifies the religious. Sex, you see, and reproduction. We are closer to the animals, women. We bleed when we don't want to. We give birth the way the animals do. In fact, women tend to prove that we are, from my point of view, just another creature, not special.
Rachel, what about you? Does religion oppress women?
From my perspective, religion doesn't really exist outside of human beings. And human beings are fallible and make lots of mistakes.
Yes.
So the religious institutions that we have are human institutions. And at times they have been very misogynistic and they have been incredibly oppressive to women. When you interpret a religion, it depends on what spectacles you're wearing. So if you have a pair of spectacles that says that women are deficient or women are somehow lesser than men, then that's the type of religion that results. But then again, if you have the type of spectacles that says we should work for egalitarianism, that men and women are equal, then you have a religion that is not oppressive to women. Because religion is always interpreted through human beings, it can be oppressive if it's read in a misogynistic way, or it can be very egalitarian. I mean, obviously, if you have a religion that is full of texts that say, you know, horrible things about women, then it's going to be very hard to read an egalitarian religion out of that.
Anthony, can I ask you, from your perspective, does religion oppress women?
To me, the question undeniably has to be answered yes. I agree with Jane. I mean, the reality is, for example, in much of the world today, there is still what can only be called gender apartheid. I mean, one looks across the Middle East, in many other parts of the world as well. There is a sense, I think, that religion is used to justify oppression, and obviously reproduction is a big part of that. Even in a so-called first country like the US, there are growing pressures in certain states to restrict abortion rights for women at sort of beyond 20 weeks pregnancy. I think the question we talk about in the book, and this is an interesting one, is does religion inherently oppress women? In other words, the way it is utilized by countless priests, clerics, etc., in so many countries clearly oppresses women. Does that mean inherently that Christianity, say, or Judaism has to oppress women? I would possibly argue no, but unfortunately, in the vast majority of cases, you can't but say, including in the Jewish religion, especially in Orthodox Judaism, there is a difference, and as Jane rightly says, separate but different. And the reality is that in many, say, Orthodox Jewish communities, for example, men and women are not seated together in the synagogue like in mosques, and that's not accidental. The women are deliberately not at the front. Now, women obviously have the right to pray and do their Jewish thing, but the fact is it's really about the men, you know, getting off on the wonderful Torah, and the women are kind of there chat about shopping and reproduction. Now, of course, I'm not saying that's how all women think, obviously, but the way that women are placed within that sort of space seems to be quite derogatory.
Simon, what's your response to that? Religion oppressing women.
Well, this is one of the chapters where I get a bit depressed because I agree largely with Jane and Anthony. So, yes, there's no question that it does. I fully agree with that. It does and has, and you know, it still does today. And that includes Christianity, by the way. I think it's a bit rough to kind of say there's this thing called religion and then sort of lump it all together because there are enormous variations within that, and some do better on this score than others, but you know, it can't be denied. My answer, though, is to... Well, I sound very defensive, I suppose, but I want to keep coming back to the core of the Christian faith, and does that oppress women? And I think the early centuries of Christianity provide us with a picture that is an enormously positive one for women. We could go into some of the details if we wanted to, but I do think that's an age where there was enormous steps forward in terms of women. I think the way Jesus treated women, the way the early church gave opportunities to women and was mocked as a religion of women and slaves, tells us something about this changed status of women. Once Christianity gets caught up into the power structures of the Roman Empire, I do think the situation changes, becomes more murky. The history hasn't always been great. But we want to keep coming back to the core of the faith. And this idea that all people are made in the image of God, both male and female, is right at the basis of the Christian understanding of the person. And that, I think, is a very lofty vision for both men and women.
My final question to you all is this. After thinking through these questions and interacting with each other, has anyone changed your mind about anything, or did you learn anything, given pause for thought? First, Rachel.
I was actually surprised at how much my parents' faith, which was Baha'i, has still kind of resonated. Like, I really was quite surprised at how much it sort of still came through. And also the other thing that I was quite surprised at was that atheism can be quite complex. It's different in the way that it's expressed through Jane and through Anthony, and I was quite surprised at how different it could be. I suppose it sounds a little bit silly given that obviously religious positions can be so different. But that's what I'd find was challenging, interesting.
Nothing changed your mind, though?
No, I wouldn't say changed my mind, but I think probably give me a little bit of pause for thought before I make assumptions.
Simon, what about you? Have you changed your view? Have you been given pause for thought?
I've changed my view, but I love the discussion. I love the conversation, and it always causes me to keep thinking through my thoughts, try to have empathy and hear other voices. I hope there's a real connection and empathy among us. I think we have seen the things we agree on, and there's plenty of those things. The things we disagree on, there are lots of those too. And then I think part of the exercise has been to see how do we then relate as friends. And I think we've been able to do that. That's been the best part for me.
I've loved reading through it all, actually, that people can disagree respectfully and civilly. Anthony, what about you? Learn anything along the way?
Yes. I mean, I didn't radically change my view, but I think one thing that is really important that I felt, and I wrote this at the end, is particularly in relation to Simon and Rachel. Jane and I mostly agree on most things. We have disagreements, but mostly we agree on these questions. But I think the importance is if one does have belief, and obviously Simon and Rachel do, it's vital that people like that are within those faiths bringing a reforming, in my view, small L liberal agenda. And those that are important to do with women's rights, reproductive rights, all those kind of questions. And as I said, I'm not probably likely to become a Muslim or Christian anytime soon, but if there are going to be people who are in that faith, of which there are billions, having people like Simon and Rachel, I think, is vital in there. And I guess I'm happy that someone like Jane, who is a the main difference we disagree on is the question of the whole new atheist movement, the Dawkins, Hitchens, yeah, which we haven't got time to go into here. But I think ultimately, I think what I learnt was, and maybe a respect to sort of say, if one's going to be within a religion, that it's important and vital that there are people who aren't going to necessarily become atheists like me or Jane.
Jane, what about you? What was this process like for you?
I echo what everybody else has said. I found it really interesting. I found it particularly interesting to think seriously about those questions in a kind of considered way. You never get that opportunity, really, so that was just fantastic. And I think I dropped a few prejudices, which I talked about in the book as well, that I had a kind of view, an unconscious bias, which is, of course, what most prejudices are. Everybody who claims not to be prejudiced almost always turns out to be. An unconscious bias that there was, it wasn't that religious people were necessarily stupid, but it was a kind of stupid thing to believe. Just an unconscious bias about that. It's been really good to A, recognise there was some vestiges of that still left, and to find that dropped completely away, which was great. I also learned an enormous amount about the situation in Palestine and Israel,
yes,
which I found incredibly, really helpful and really interesting. And I also learned a lot about how to have a vigorous and respectful debate. I think that all of us need to remind ourselves about that. And also the richness and diversity of different perspectives is really valuable. I don't want, and I hear Anthony and I might disagree, I don't actually think the new atheists, as they are so called, want to actually rid the world of religion per se or faith. They may want to rid the kind of preferential treatment of religion in terms of its impact on the public sphere, its impact on education, its tax-free status, some of those kinds of things, absolutely. But the idea of ridding the world of people who believe in a God, I don't think that's anybody's aim. We just are now starting to claim perhaps the right that those who believe shouldn't get preferences in some areas over those who don't believe.
I think it's been an important book to compile. A thoroughly enjoyable conversation on Open House, a very Open House conversation. So thanks to Jane Caro, Anthony Lowenstein, Simon Smart and Rachel Woodlock for being with us on Open House. We'll put the details of For God's Sake up on our Open House community Facebook page. Thanks, guys, so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.